Hello, everyone. Welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And we have some science news or some COVID news that you can use. And
Yes.
Thank you. No, it is, I think, interesting. And actually, the first one is maybe a study that you can't use, or I think is making the rounds right now on social media. And I don't think it's really relevant for anything. And this study is about Omicron. And it's like a time travel. Back to that, you remember that period of time when there was all this new research about how long the novel coronavirus could survive on a surface? So they compared it to plastic, to
cardboard,
metal. How long? And all of us latched. I'm talking about myself here as a science journalist. We latched onto that information. Whoa, maybe that's why this thing is spreading. Maybe everyone, you know, it's sitting on the surfaces in a grocery store or on that.
Back when you were afraid to touch anything?
Back when it was all...
March, April 2020?
When it was all about the hand hygiene and disinfecting, and you should still be doing that, but not as important as we once thought. Still, there's new research that kind of takes the next logical step. What's happening with Omicron on surfaces? This comes out of Japan, out of Kyoto, and it's a preprint, so it has to be examined by other scientists who may say, hey, you know, this study wasn't done properly. What they found... is the Omicron variant, here are the two chief conclusions. For 20 hours long, this virus, under perfect conditions, can stay on your skin. Okay, that's finding number one.
For 20 hours.
Omicron, 20 hours, you can round it up to one day if you want to say it today, can stay on your skin. On plastic, the Omicron variant of the coronavirus can, in theory, survive for up to 8 days. Mm-hmm. This, you know, for those people listening out there, might seem scary and might seem really relevant, right? Well, if it can stay on plastic for 8 days, that's not good. And it also immediately reminded me of this bizarre news story, allegations out of China, that the Omicron variant arrived there, I think, on a package out of Canada, blaming Canada for the Omicron.
Blame Canada, yeah.
Well, you know what? I don't think any of that is true, and I don't think this information is all that important. Now, to add a little bit more to it, the Omicron variant is not really doing all that much that's different from the variants before it. That's why I'm not sure how relevant this would even be. The original coronavirus variant out of Wuhan, that could survive on plastic for 50 hours. So that's less than the 8 days. 8 days is close to 200 hours. The Alpha variant was also about 200 hours. Beta, 150. Gamma, 60. Delta, 115. And as I said, Omicron can survive on plastic for about 200 hours. So yes, they all vary, but is there really a connection, you know, between, I mean, the implication or one of the open questions in this study is, you know, this can survive for so long, hence it may therefore be more infectious, or that's the infectiousness.
I was going to jump in and just stop you. Does this matter at all? Because
no.
It seems like the way that people are getting infected...
through the air.
Nose and
through
mouth.
The air. By sitting inside in a room like this one and talking to each other, you know, that is how the Omicron variant spreads. We all know this.
Yeah.
And again, going to the skin, you have a similar lineup of how long... You know, the Omicron, sure, it can survive on skin in theory for 20 hours. So could Alpha. And Alpha was not as infectious as the Omicron variant.
I could have Omicron on my arms and legs and back and anywhere else if it's not in my lungs or if it's not in my mucus or in my throat. Then it doesn't matter.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, and maybe I've done the world an injustice here to all our listeners, because the whole point of this is the kind of study that can appear important. Wow. Or, you know, it's just the headline that most people get. Up to 8 days, Omicron can survive for 8 days on plastic. That's not really very relevant for this pandemic or for the spread of this virus.
Yep. So this functions as a reminder then?
It's a reminder.
And if you see this study, don't be alarmed. It doesn't mean...
It's a reminder.
Omicron is any more dangerous or anything like that.
Exactly. And it's just another look at how, unfortunately, it took way too long to get that message out. The message that it's not, you know, you touching something and then touching your eyeball or your nose or your mouth. That is a good way for viruses to spread. That happens with a lot of other viruses as well. And it can lead to an infection with the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. Yeah. It is through the air when you're inside. So stay outside.
Okay. I've got some numbers. Specifically from Germany, but this is a phenomenon that is worldwide. Men die way, way more often from COVID-19 than women.
When you say way, way, way,
yeah, here
more
we go.
Often.
Here we go. Okay, this is divided into three groups. So we're looking at age groups from 35 to 59.
Mm-hmm.
And just so that you know, Women, there were 1.67 million cases of COVID-19 for women, and there were 1.53 million cases for men. So relatively the same.
Close enough to say it's about equal.
4,300 men died during that time out of those cases, and 1,800 women died.
2.5 times men more men died
from COVID-19. That was 35 to 59, so relatively young. Now let's move to 60 to 79. 23,000 males died, or 23,400 males, and 12,000 women.
About half.
Again.
Now you're reminding me of...
Two times more.
Speaking
deaths
about,
among men than women.
Speaking about the early part of the pandemic, this reminds me way back when these numbers first started trickling out of Wuhan, China, or various large cities in China, and this death gap or this death disparity, the fact that more men were dying, one argument that ultimately got debunked way later was that, oh, right, that's because men, at least in China, tend to smoke more. And that perhaps, and it turned out, I believe there was not only no connection, but there was even an argument later that the opposite might be happening. It was really strange. In any case, it's not about smoking. Why are men dying?
That is one of the factors, but not everywhere in the world. So what we need to find, it's speculation at this point, nobody knows. There are German immunologists who have weighed in on this question, one of them Ute Zeeland, and she seems to say it has something to do with the immune system of women, that because they have to deal with pregnancies and other human beings being in their womb, that their immune systems are stronger. And that would make sense if you think about the prevalence of immunodeficiencies, women. There are more women with type 1 diabetes. There are more women
autoimmune.
With multiple sclerosis, autoimmune disorders. That is just the case, and that would ring true. But how exactly this happens, that at this point, it's just speculation.
I was going to say, because I remember coming across that theory at one point, and I read a counterpoint to it, which is that, well, if women have a quote-unquote stronger immune system or have a stronger reaction, that could be great at the very beginning of an infection, but when a lot of cells are infected, particularly in the lungs, there could be that, you know, cytokine storm. There could be an overreaction leading to the cellular death of healthy cells.
Yeah, there was a just to jump on what you just said. There was a study that came out recently that looked at these interferons, these proteins in our nose, in our throat, that fight off infection very fast. Kids have them. In high concentration, women have them more than men. And they found, they were looking into who gets a severe COVID-19 infection. And what they did find is that the people who did get a severe COVID-19 infection, they had less of these interferons in them. And one explanation would be because women have these stronger immune systems, or, you know, supposedly have these stronger immune systems, that would mean that they have more interferons, which would kill off COVID quicker. And lead to less severe COVID eventually, and that could be killing the men off.
There would be some logic in that. That was the out of Frankfurt that
correct.
Study on the interferons.
Correct.
Yeah, if this is a topic that I've been thinking about for a while, and if you want my absolute hottest hot take,
oh yes, give it to me.
Yeah, you want this one? Yeah. The one that I've been too afraid to publish on DW.com because I think it will provoke a very strong negative reaction, but I'll go and say it. My real question, and I'm very biased because I'm a man, and men have died at far higher rates than women have. Mm-hmm. And my question is, why didn't the vaccine campaigns reflect that? It might have been there's probably a good answer. It might have been a logistical nightmare to try to prioritize a vaccination campaign that was already difficult. I mean, like without precedent, at least in our time, to then add all of these clauses to it.
Yeah.
It's just, I wonder, I hope that people are talking about it behind the scenes and suggesting that, look, next time.
Are there social factors that playing a role there? And nobody is talking about this.
Which is odd.
I have not heard one person talk about the idea or the question or why are more men dying than women yet.
That's strange, isn't it? And I don't know why that didn't happen. And those numbers substantiate what I kind of had seen before, but not with so much data. And it just makes me wonder, this is a huge issue. That's a really big difference. And the vaccine campaign not only never reflected that, it was never even brought up publicly. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you here in Germany, you've got these ethics boards, you have the what they call the Impfrat. You've got people behind the scenes probably discussing these things. And in fact, I think it was about a year ago, I sent 3 or 4 emails out to those people.
I know who you sent that email to, Alina Books, who's on that ethics council, and she didn't want to talk about it, right?
Nobody wanted to talk about it. And I'm not being conspiratorial and saying there's some sort of conspiracy out there. I'm just, I think, again, going beyond the men-women thing, because that's almost inviting an angry debate that I don't want. I just wonder and hope that in the future, in the next pandemic, as the data is rolling in and a vaccine is being developed, that there'll be, I don't know, authorities, health agencies will do a better job of identifying exactly which groups are dying the most, and we'll go there first. That's my hope, because it didn't seem to happen this time.
Especially if it is about saving the most people, right? Whether they're men or women or whoever.
If
we know that a certain type of person is vulnerable, then do something to help save that person.
Yeah. I have one more thing to say. I'm just going to drop our email address again in here now, su@dw.com, because I really want to hear what you think about this. If you think I'm an idiot.
Question is, was it a good idea not to prioritize men in terms of the COVID-19 vaccination?
Yeah.
Really, it is. It's an open question.
And if authorities came to the conclusion, they did, that it wasn't a good idea, I would love to find out, because I've been trying to find out and I don't know at this point.
Speaking, got one more thing here.
One last thing, I'll make it quick. Speaking of the vaccination campaign and how it should be happening differently, this comes in the form of a letter, an open letter written to the Prime Minister of the UK, to Boris Johnson, and signed by more than, I think, 350 scientists there, and saying, basically, please spread the vaccine around the world better. There are 3 billion people around the world who have not received their first dose. I know for many of our listeners out there, it's like that first injection seems so long ago now. There are 3 billion people who've never had one. More boosters have been delivered in rich countries than the total number of all doses administered so far in poorer countries.
You could almost just provide these numbers without even commenting on them. I don't think they even need any comment.
The disparity is astounding.
It's like enough said. Just say the numbers.
Yeah, no, that's enough. And then, you know, you listening are probably wondering, what should happen? Should we just give up all our vaccines and let everyone else have them? It is difficult to talk about what should actually happen, but the suggestion here is actually different. They have two concrete requests, and this is specifically for the UK government, but it would apply to many different countries around the world. They're asking the government to support the temporary waiver of intellectual property rules under, you know, a couple of different trade-related acts, which would allow countries around the world to scale up and diversify the production of the tools needed to end the pandemic. The second point that they're saying is to please use all means at the British government's disposal to kind of pressure, they use the word pressure, not force, pharmaceutical companies to share their technology and know-how with the World Health Organization's COVID-19 technology access pool and its mRNA technology transfer hub in South Africa. A lot of words. What does it mean? Share the intellectual information that we have and give other countries, kind of waive what are typically, I don't know, patents or property rights, waive those and allow other countries to manufacture them. Because we are...
Yeah, and get the vaccines that are easier to transport and store there to these countries.
Or
start producing there.
Right, but I think they're thinking even more long. It's that second part, the producing. They're thinking even more long term. Let's give countries around the world the ability to make this stuff for themselves, so that it doesn't feel like a question of, do I have to share it? Does my booster go away because that guy or that woman over there gets their shot? And there you run into people having very conflicted feelings about what should or should not happen.
I can understand that sentiment maybe a half a year ago, but not now.
No, it's time to get the rest of the world going on this. Now, final thing I'll say on this one, I did talk to a German friend of mine who's very heavily involved in the pharmaceutical industry here, and he had a very different take on this idea and was saying, look, sure, wonderful, wonderful in theory, but you have to make sure that the wonderful quality control measures that you have, you know, when vaccines are produced here in Germany or in other countries around the world, that those are followed elsewhere and that you don't end up with, you know, vaccine of lesser quality that then increases vaccine skepticism. You have to do it right, and you have to have trained people running those facilities.
That's what I was going to say. You're going to have to train people up. The learning curve is going to be insane for the first bit.
It'll take a while.
It's possible. Everything's possible.
And let's start now.
Yeah.
Let's start
yesterday.
People have been talking about this for a year. Let's start doing it now. That is the last message for today. A
lot of stuff today. If you have anything to share criticisms of what we said, Connor in particular.
I can feel them coming. I think they're coming.
SU@dw.com.